Worse things had happened to some of the boys who had left Southern Oregon with Johnny Stevens nearly 2 weeks ago. Johnny himself must have been through hell. He still looked 17, though, sitting near the fire, nursing a steaming mug of broth. The young man needed a hot bath and maybe 40 hours' sleep. His long, sandy hair and sparse beard covered innumerable small scratches, and only one part of his uniform was untattered, a neatly repaired emblem that bore the simple legend, Postal Service of the Restored United States.
Gordon!
He grinned broadly and stood up. I prayed you would return safely, Gordon said, embracing Johnny. He pushed aside the sheaf of dispatches the youth drew from his oilskin pouch, for which Johnny doubtless would have given his life. I'll look at those in a little while. Sit. Drink your soup. Gordon took a moment to glance over toward the big fireplace, where the new southern recruits were being tended by the refectory staff. One boy's arm was in a sling. Another, lying on a table, was having a scalp gash tended by Dr. Pilch, the Army's physician. The rest sipped from steaming mugs and stared at Gordon in frank curiosity. Obviously, Johnny had been filling their ears with stories. They looked eager, ready to fight. And not one of them was over 16.
So much for our last hope,
Gordon thought. People in the mid-southern part of Oregon had been fighting the Rogue River survivalists for nearly 20 years, and in the last 10 or so had managed to beat the barbarians to a standstill. Unlike Gordon's northerners, the ranchers and farmers down around Roseburg had not been weakened by years of peace. They were tough and knew their enemy well. They also had real leaders. There was one man Gordon had heard of who had driven back one Holiness raid after another in bloody disarray. No doubt that was why the enemy had come up with their new plan. In a bold stroke, the Holiness had taken to sea, landing up the coast at Florence, far north of their traditional foes. It was a brilliant move, and now there was nothing to stop them. The southern farmers had sent only 10 boys to help. 10 boys. The recruits stood up as Gordon approached. He went down the line asking each his name, his hometown. They shook his hand earnestly, and each addressed him as Mr. Inspector. No doubt they all hoped to earn the highest honor, to become postmen, officers of a nation they were too young ever to have known. Neither that nor the fact that the nation no longer existed would keep them from dying for it, Gordon knew. He noticed Phil Bocuto sitting in a corner, whittling. The black ex-Marine said nothing, but Gordon could tell he was sizing up the Southerners already, and Gordon agreed. If any of them had any skill at all, they would be made scouts, whatever Dina and her women said. Gordon sensed her watching from the back of the room. She had to know he would never agree to her new plan, not while he was in command of the Army of the Lower Willamette, not while he had a breath left in his body. He spent some minutes talking with the recruits. When he next looked back toward the door Dina had left, perhaps to carry word to her cabal of would-be Amazons, Gordon was resigned to an inevitable confrontation. Johnny Stevens fingered the oilskin pouch as Gordon returned to the table. This time the young man would not be put off. He held out the packet he had carried so far.
I'm sorry, Gordon.
He kept his voice low.
I did my best, but they just wouldn't listen. I delivered your letters, but...
He shook his head. Gordon leafed through replies to the entreaties for help he had written more than 2 months ago. They all did want to join the postal network, Johnny added with irony in his voice. Even if we fall up here, I suppose there'll still be a sliver of Oregon free and ready when the nation reaches here. On the yellowed envelopes, Gordon recognized the names of towns all around Roseburg, some legendary even up here. He scanned some of the replies. They were courteous, curious, even enthusiastic about the stories of a reborn U.S., but there were no promises and no troops. What about George Powhatan? Johnny shrugged.
All the other mayors and sheriffs and bosses down there look to him. They won't do anything without he does it first.
I don't see Powhatan's reply. He had looked at all the letters. Johnny shook his head.
Hal Hatton said he didn't trust paper, Gordon. Anyway, his answer was only two words long. He asked me to tell it to you direct.
Johnny's voice fell.
He said to tell you, I'm sorry.
4. Lights shone under the door as Gordon returned to his room much later in the evening. His hand hesitated inches from the knob. He clearly remembered snuffing the candles earlier, before leaving to commune with Cyclops. A soft, female scent solved the mystery before he had the door more than half open. He saw Dina on his bed, her legs under the covers. She wore a loose shirt of white homespun and held a book up close to the bedside candle. "That's bad for your eyes," he said, as he dropped Johnny's dispatch pouch onto his desk. Dina replied without looking up from her book.
"I agree. May I remind you that you are the one who put your room back into the Stone Age while the rest of this building is electrified? I suppose you pre-war types still have it in your silly heads that candlelight is somehow romantic. Is that it?"
Gordon wasn't exactly sure why he had taken down the electric bulbs in his room and carefully packed them away. During his first few weeks in Corvallis, he'd felt a lump of joy every time he had a chance to turn a switch and make electrons flow again, as they had in the days of his youth. Now, in his own room, at least, he could not bear the sweetness of such light. Gordon poured water and then soda powder over his toothbrush. "You have a good 40-watt bulb in your own room," he reminded her. "You could do your reading there." Dina ignored the pointed remark and instead used the flat of her hand to slap the open book.
"I don't understand this," she declared, exasperated. "According to this book, America was having a cultural renaissance just before the Doom War. Sure, there was Nathan Holm preaching his mad doctrine of supermachismo, and there were problems with the Slavic mystics overseas, but for the most part it was a brilliant time. In art, music, science, everything seemed about to come together. And yet these surveys taken at the end of the century say that the majority of American women of that time still mistrusted technology. I can't believe it. Is it true? Are they all idiots?"
Gordon spat into the wash basin and looked up at the cover of the book. It bore a legend in bright holographic print. "Who We Are, a Portrait of America in the 1990s. He shook out his toothbrush. "It wasn't that simple, Dina. Technology had been thought of as a male occupation for thousands of years. Even in the 90s, only a small fraction of the engineers and scientists were women, though there were more and more damn fine..."
"That's irrelevant," Dina interrupted.
She shut the book and shook her light brown hair in emphasis.
"What's important is who benefits. Even if it was mostly a male art, technology helped women far more than men. Compare America of your time with the world today and tell me I'm wrong."
"The present is hell for women," he agreed. Gordon picked up the pitcher and poured water over his washcloth. He felt very tired. "Life is far worse for them than it is even for men. It's brutish, painful, and short. And to my shame, I let you persuade me to put girls in the worst, most dangerous..." Dina seemed determined not to let him finish a sentence. Or was it that she sensed his pain over young Tracy Smith's death and wanted to change the subject?
"Fine," she said. "Then what I want to know is why women were afraid of technology before the war, if this crazy book is right, when science had done so much for them, when the alternative was so terrible."
Gordon rehung the damp cloth. He shook his head. It had all been so long ago. Since those days, in his travels, he had seen horrors that would leave Dina stunned speechless if ever he managed to make himself speak of them. She had been only an infant when civilization came crashing down. Except for the terrible days before her adoption into the House of Cyclops, no doubt by now long gone from her memory, she had grown up in perhaps the only place in the world today where a vestige of the old comforts still maintained. No wonder she had no gray hairs yet at the ripe age of 22. "There are those who say technology was the very thing that wrecked civilization," he suggested. He sat on the chair next to the bed and closed his eyes, hoping she might take a hint and leave in a little while. He spoke without moving. "Those people may have a point. The bombs and bugs, the 3-year winter, the ruined networks of an interdependent society. This time she did not interrupt. It was his own voice that caught of its own accord. He could not recite the litany aloud. Hospitals, universities, restaurants, sleek airplanes that carried free citizens anywhere they might want to go. Laughing, clear-eyed children dancing in the spray of lawn sprinklers. Pictures sent back from the moons of Jupiter and Neptune. Dreams of the stars. And wonderful, wise machines who wove delicious puns and made us proud. Knowledge.
Anti-tech bullshit, Dina said, dismissing his suggestion in 2 words. It was people, not science, that wrecked the world. You know that, Gordon. It was certain types of people.
Gordon lacked the will even to shrug. What did it matter now, anyway? When she spoke again, her voice was softer.
Come here. We'll get you out of those sweaty clothes.
Gordon started to protest. Tonight he only wanted to curl up and close out the world, to postpone tomorrow's decisions in a drowning of unconsciousness. But Dina was strong and adamant. Her fingers worked his buttons and pulled him over to sag back against the pillows. They carried her scent.
I know why it all fell apart, Dina declared as she worked. The book was right. Women simply didn't pay close enough attention. Feminism got sidetracked onto issues that were at best peripheral and ignored the real problem. Men. You fellows were doing your job well enough, shaping and making and building things. Males can be brilliant that way. But anyone with any sense can see that a quarter to half of you are also lunatics, rapists, and murderers. It was our job to keep an eye on you, to cultivate the best and cull the bastards.
She nodded, completely satisfied with her logic.
We women are the ones who failed, who let it happen.
Gordon muttered, Dina, you are certifiably crazy, do you know that? He already realized what she was driving at. This was just another attempt to twist him around to agreeing to another mad scheme to win the war. But this time it wasn't going to work. At the front of his mind, he wished the would-be Amazon would simply go away and leave him alone. But her scent was inside his head, and even with his eyes closed, he knew it. When her homespun shirt fell soundlessly to the floor, and she blew out the candle.
Maybe I am crazy, she said, but I do know what I'm talking about.
The covers lifted and she slid alongside him.
I know it. It was our fault.
The smooth stroke of her skin was like electricity along his flank. Gordon's body seemed to rise even while, behind his eyelids, he tried to cling to his pride and the escape of sleep.
But we women aren't going to let it happen again, Dina whispered.
She nuzzled his neck and ran her fingertips along his shoulder and biceps.
We've learned about men, about the heroes and the bastards, and how to tell the difference. And we're learning about ourselves, too.
Her skin was hot. Gordon's arms wound around her, and he pulled her down beside him.
This time, Dina sighed, we're going to make a difference.
Gordon firmly covered her mouth with his, if for no other reason than to get her to stop talking at last. 5.
As young Mark here will demonstrate, even a child can use our new infrared night vision scope combined with a laser spotter beam to pick out a target in almost pitch darkness.
The Willamette Valley Defense Council sat behind a long table on the stage of the largest lecture hall on the old Oregon State University campus, watching as Peter Egg displayed the latest secret weapon to come out of the laboratories of the servants of Cyclops. Gordon could barely make out the lanky technician when the lights were turned off and the doors closed. But Egg's voice was stentoriously clear.
Up at the back of the hall, we have placed a mouse in a cage to represent an enemy infiltrator. Mark, now switches on the sniper scope.
There came a soft click in the darkness.
Now he scans for the heat radiation given off by the mouse.
I see it,
the child's voice piped.
Good boy. Now, Mark swings the laser over to bear on the animal. Got him! And once the beam is locked into place, our spotter changes laser frequencies so that a visible spot shows the rest of us the mouse.
Gordon peered at the dark area up at the back of the hall. Nothing had happened. There was still only a deep darkness. Someone in the audience giggled.
Maybe it got eight,
a voice cracked.
Yeah! Hey, maybe you techs ought to tune that thing to look for a cat instead.
Someone gave a rumbling meow. Although the council chairman was banging his gavel, Gordon joined the wise guys down below in laughing out loud. He was tempted to interject a remark of his own, but everyone knew his voice. His role here was a somber one, and he would probably only hurt somebody's feelings. A bustle of activity over to the left told of a gathering of techs whispering urgently together. Finally, someone called for the lights. The fluorescents flickered on, and the members of the Defense Council blinked as their eyes readapted. Mark Egg, the 10-year-old boy Gordon had rescued from survivalists in the ruins of Eugene some months ago, removed his night vision helmet and looked up.
I could see the mouse,
he insisted.
Real good. And I hit him with the laser beam, but it wouldn't switch colors.
Peter Egg looked embarrassed. The blonde man wore the same black-trimmed white as the techs still huddled over the balky device.
It worked through 50 trials yesterday,
he explained.
Maybe the parametric converter got stuck. It does sometimes. Of course, this is only a prototype, and nobody here in Oregon has tried to build anything like this in nearly 20 years. But we ought to have the bugs out of it before we go into production.
Three different groups made up the Defense Council. The two men and a woman who were dressed like Peter, in servants' robes, nodded sympathetically. The rest of the counselors seemed less understanding. Two men, to Gordon's right, wore blue tunics and leather jackets similar to his own. On their sleeves were sewn patches depicting an eagle rising defiantly from a pyre, rimmed by the legend, Restored U.S. Postal Service. Gordon's fellow postmen looked at each other, one rolling his eyes in disgust. In the middle sat two women and three men, including the council chairman, representing the various regions in the alliance, counties once tied together by their reverence of Cyclops, more recently by a growing postal network, and now by their fear of a common foe. Their clothing was varied, but each wore an armband bearing a shiny emblem, a W and a V superimposed to stand for Willamette Valley. The chromed symbols were one item plentiful enough to be supplied the entire army, salvaged from long-abandoned motor cars. It was one of these civilian representatives who spoke first.
Just how many of these gadgets do you think you techs can put together by springtime?
Peter thought.
Well, if we go all out, I guess we ought to have a dozen or so fixed up by the end of March.
And they'll all need electricity, I suppose?
We'll provide hand generators, of course. The entire kit ought to weigh no more than 50 pounds, all told.
The farmers looked at each other. The woman representing the Cascade Indian community seemed to speak for all of them.
I'm sure these night scopes might do some good defending a few important sites against sneak attacks, but I want to know how they'll help after the snow melts, when those Holness dick cutters come down raiding and burning all our little hamlets and villages one by one. We can't pull the whole population into Corvallis, you know. We'd starve in weeks.
Yeah,
another farmer added. Where are all those super weapons you big domes were supposed to be coming up with? Have you guys switched Cyclops off, or what? It was the servants' turn to look at each other. Their leader, Dr. Tager, started to protest.
That's not fair. We've hardly had any time. Cyclops was built for peaceful uses and has to reprogram himself to deal with things like war. Anyway, he can come up with great plans, but it's fallible men who have to implement them.
To Gordon, it was a marvel. Here, in public, the man actually seemed hurt, defensive of his mechanical oracle, which the people of the valley still revered like Great Oz. The representative of the northern townships shook his head, respectful but obstinate.
Now, I'd be the last one to criticize Cyclops. I'm sure he's cranking out the ideas as fast as he can, but I just can't see where this nightscope is any better than that balloon thing you keep talking about, or those gas bombs, or those gimmicky little mines. There just aren't enough of them to do any damn good. And even if you made hundreds, thousands, they'd be great if we were fighting a real army like in Vietnam or Kenya before the doom time, but they're nearly useless against the damn survivalists.
Although he kept silent, Gordon couldn't help agreeing. Dr. Tager looked down at his hands. After 16 years of peaceful, benign hoaxing, doling out a small stream of recycled 20th century wonders to keep the area farmers entranced, he and his technicians were being called on to deliver real miracles at last. Fixing toys and wind-driven electric generators to impress the locals just wouldn't suffice anymore. The man sitting to Gordon's right stirred. It was Eric Stevens, young Johnny Stevens' grandfather. The old man wore the same uniform as Gordon and represented the upper Willamette region, those few towns just south of Eugene that had joined the alliance.
"So we're back to square one," Stevens said. "Cyclops' gimmicks can help here and there. Mostly they'll make a few strong points a bit stronger. But I think we're all in agreement that that won't do much more than inconvenience the enemy. Likewise, Gordon tells us that we can't expect help from the civilized East anywhere near in time. It's a decade or more before the restored U.S. will arrive out here in any force. We have to hold out at least that long, maybe, before real contact is established."
The old man looked at the others fiercely.
"There's only one way to do that. And that's to fight!"
He pounded the table.
"It all comes down to basics once again. Men are what'll make the difference."
There was a mutter of agreement down the table, but Gordon was acutely aware of Dina, sitting in the seats below, waiting her chance to address the council. She was shaking her head, and Gordon felt as if he could read her mind. Not just men, she was thinking. The tall young woman wore the robes of a servant, but Gordon knew where her real loyalties lay. She sat with three of her disciples, buckskin-clad female scouts in the Army of the Willamette, all members of her eccentric cabal. Until now, the council would have rejected their scheme out of hand. The girls had barely been allowed to join the army at all, and then only out of a latent sense of last-century feminism that lingered in this still-civilized valley. But Gordon sensed the growing desperation at the table today. The news Johnny Stevens had brought home from the South had struck hard. Soon, when the snows stopped falling and the warm rains began again, the counselors would begin grasping at any plan, any idiocy at all. Gordon decided to enter this discussion before things got out of hand. The chairman quickly deferred when Gordon lifted his hand. "I'm sure the council wishes to convey to Cyclops and to his technicians our gratitude for their unceasing efforts." There was a mutter of agreement. Neither Tager nor Peter Egg met his eyes. "We have perhaps another 6 or 8 weeks of bad weather on our side before we can look for a resumption of major activity by the enemy. After hearing the reports of the training and ordnance committees, it's clear we have our work cut out for us." Indeed, Philip Bakuto's summary had begun the morning's litany of bad news. Gordon took a breath.
"When the Holnest invasion began last summer, I told you all not to expect any help from the rest of the nation. Establishing a postal network, as I have been doing with your help, is only the first step in a long process until the continent can be reunited. For years to come, Oregon will stand essentially alone."
He managed to lie by implication, while speaking words that were the literal truth, a skill he had grown good at, if not proud of.
"I won't mince words with you. The failure of the people of the Roseburg region to send more than a dribble of aid has been the worst blow of all. The southern folk have the experience, the skill, and most of all, the leadership we need. In my opinion, persuading them to help us must take priority over everything else. He paused. I shall go south personally then and try to get them to change their minds.
That brought on an immediate tumult.
Gordon, that's crazy. Well, you can't... We need you here.
He closed his eyes. In 4 months, he had welded an alliance strong enough to delay and frustrate the invaders. He had forged it mostly through his skill as a storyteller, a posturer, a liar. Gordon had no illusions that he was a real leader. It was his image that held the army of the Willamette together, his legendary authority as the Inspector, a manifestation of the nation reborn. A nation whose only remaining spark will soon be stone cold dead if something isn't done damn quick. I can't lead these people. They need a general, a warrior. They need a man like George Powhatan. He cut the uproar by holding up a hand.
I am going. And I want you all to promise me you'll not agree to any crazy, desperate enterprises while I'm away.
He looked directly at Dina. For an instant, she met his gaze, but her lips were tight, and after a moment her eyes clouded and she jerked her head aside. Is she concerned for me or for her plan?
I'll be back before spring, he promised. I'll be back with help.
Under his breath, he added, or I'll be dead. 6. It took 3 days to get ready. All that time, Gordon chafed, wishing he could simply be off. But it had turned into an expedition, the council insisting that Bokuto and 4 other men accompany him at least as far as Cottage Grove. Johnny Stevens and one of the southern volunteers rode ahead to prepare the way. After all, it was only fitting that the inspector be well heralded. To Gordon, it was all a lot of nonsense. An hour with Johnny, spent going over a pre-war roadmap, would be enough to tell him how to get where he was going. One fast horse and another for remount would protect him as well as an entire squad. Gordon particularly resented having to take Bokuto. The man was needed here. But the council was adamant. It was accept their terms or not be allowed to go at all. The party departed Corvallis early in the morning, their horses steaming in the bitter cold as they rode out past the old OSU athletic field. A column of marching recruits passed by. Muffled as they were, it was nonetheless easy to tell from their chanting voices that these were more of Dina's girl soldiers.
Oh, I won't marry a man who smokes, who scratches, belches, or bellows bad jokes. I might not marry at all, at all. I might not marry at all. Oh, I would rather just sit in the shade and be a choosy, picky old maid. Oh, I might not marry at all. I might not marry at all.
The troop performed eyes right as the men rode by. Dina's expression was masked by distance, but he felt her gaze nonetheless. Their farewell had been physically passionate and emotionally tense. Gordon wasn't sure if even pre-war America, with all its sexual variations, had ever come up with a name for the kind of relationship they had. It was a relief to be getting away from her. He knew he would miss her. As the women's voices faded behind him, Gordon's throat was tight. He tried to pass it off partly as pride in their obvious courage, but it wasn't possible to completely rule out dread. The party rode hard past barren orchards and frosted countryside to make the stockade at Roland by sundown. That was how close the lines were, 1 day's journey from the fragile center of what passed for civilization. From here on, it would be bandit country. In Roland, they heard new rumors that one contingent of Holnists had already established a small duchy in the ruins of Eugene. Refugees told of bands of the white camouflage barbarians roaming the countryside, burning small hamlets and dragging off food, women, slaves. If it was true, Eugene presented a problem. They had to get by the ruined city. Recruto insisted on taking no chances. Gordon glowered and hardly spoke at all as the expedition wasted 3 days on frozen, buckled asphalt roads, skirting far to the east of Springfield, then south again to arrive at last at the fortified town of Cottage Grove. It had been only a short time since a few towns south of Eugene had been reunited with the more prosperous communities to the north. Now the invaders had nearly cut them off again. On Gordon's mental map of the once great state of Oregon, the entire eastern two-thirds were wilderness, high desert, ancient lava flows, and the mountainous ramparts of the Cascades. The gray Pacific bounded the rain-shrouded Coast Range in the west. The northern and southern edges of the state, too, were virtually impassable blotches. In the north, the Columbia Valley still glowed from the bombs that had tortured Portland and shattered the Great River's dams. The other blot spilled 100 miles into the southern edge of the state from unknown California and centered on the mountainous canyon land known as the Rogue. Even in happier times, the area around Medford had been known for a certain strange element. Before the Doom War, it had been estimated that the Rogue River Valley held more secret caches, more illegal machine guns than anywhere outside the Everglades. While civil authority was still struggling to hang on 16 years ago, it was the hyper-survivalist plague that struck the final blow all over the civilized world. In southern Oregon, the followers of Nathan Hone had been particularly violent. The faith of the poor citizens of that region was never known. Between the desert and the sea, between radiation and the wholeness madmen, two small areas had come out of the 3-year winter with enough left to do a little more than scratch as animals. The Willamette in the north and the towns around Roseburg in the south. But in the beginning, the southernmost patch seemed surely doomed to slavery or worse at the hands of the new barbarians. Then, somewhere between the Rogue and the Umpqua, something unexpected happened. The cancer had been arrested. The enemy had been stopped. To find out how was Gordon's desperate hope before the transplanted disease took hold fully in the vulnerable Willamette Valley. On Gordon's mental map, an ugly red incursion had spread inland from the invader beachheads west of Eugene, and Cottage Grove was now nearly cut off. They got their first glimpse of how bad things had become less than a mile out of town. The bodies of 6 men hung by the road, crucified on sagging telephone poles. The corpses had not been left unmarked. "Cut them down," he ordered. Gordon's heart pounded and his mouth was dry, exactly the reaction the enemy had wanted from this exercise in calculated terror. Obviously, the men of Cottage Grove weren't even patrolling this far out anymore. That did not bode well. An hour later, he saw how much had changed since the last time he had visited the town. Watchtowers stood at the corners of new earthen ramparts. On the outside, pre-war buildings had been raised to make a broad, free-fire zone. Population had swollen threefold with refugees, most living in crowded shanties just inside the main gate. Children clung to the skirts of gaunt-faced women and stared as the riders from the north passed by. Men stood in clusters, warming their hands over open fires. The smoke mixed with a mist from unwashed bodies to make an unpleasant, aromatic fog. Some of the men looked like pretty rough customers. Gordon wondered how many of them were wholeness infiltrators only pretending to be refugees. It had happened before. There was worse news. From the town council, they learned that Mayor Peter Van Cleek had died in an ambush only days before, trying to lead a patrol to the aid of a besieged hamlet. The loss was incalculable, and it struck Gordon hard. It also helped explain the mood of stunned silence on the cold streets. He gave his best morale speech that evening by torchlight in the crowded square, but this time the cheers of the crowd were tired and ragged. His address was interrupted twice by the faint, echoing crack of gunshots carrying over the ramparts from the forest hills beyond.
"I don't give 'em 2 months once the snow melts," Bakudo whispered the next day as they rode out of Cottage Grove. "2 weeks if the damn survivalists try hard."
Gordon did not have to reply. The town was the southern linchpin of the Alliance. When it collapsed, there would be nothing to prevent the full force of the enemy from turning north to the heartland of the valley and Corvallis itself. They rode south in a light flurry of snow, climbing the coast fork of the Willamette River toward its source. The dark green pine forest glistened under its white blanket. Here and there, the bright red bark of myrtlewood stood out against the gray banks of the half-frozen stream. Still, a few obstinate mergansers fished the icy waters, trying in their own way to survive until spring. South of the abandoned town of London, they left the diminished river. There followed a long, uninhabited stretch, featured only by the overgrown ruins of farms and an occasional tumbled-down gas station. It had been a silent trek so far, but now, at last, security lightened a bit as even the suspicious Philip Bakudo felt sure they were beyond the likely range of Holness patrols. Talking was allowed. There was even laughter. All of the men were over 30, so they played the remember game, telling old-time jokes that would have no meaning at all to any of the new generation, and arguing lightheartedly over dimly recollected sports arcana. Gordon nearly fell out of his saddle laughing as Aaron Schimmel gave nasal impressions of popular television personalities of the 90s. "It's amazing how much of our youth gets stored away, ready to be recalled," he commented to Philip. "They used to say one sign of getting old is when you remember things from 20 years ago easier than recent events."
"Yeah," Bakudo said, grinning, and his voice took on a querulous falsetto.
"What was it we were just talking about?"
Gordon tapped the side of his head.
"Eh? Can't hear you, fella. Too much rock and roll way back when."
The men grew accustomed to the cold bite of wintry mornings and the soft pad of horses' hooves on the grass-covered interstate. The land had recovered. Deer grazed these forests once again, but man would for a long time be too sparse to come back and retake all the abandoned villages. The Coast Fork tributaries fell away at last. The travelers crossed a narrow line of hills, and a day later found themselves by the banks of a new stream. "The Umpqua," their guide identified. The northerners stared. This chilled torrent did not empty into the placid Willamette, and thence the great Columbia. Rather, it carved its own untamed way westward toward the sea.
"Welcome to sunny southern Oregon," Bakudo muttered, subdued once again.
The skies glowered down on them. Even the trees seemed wilder than up north. The impression held as they began passing small, stockaded settlements once again. Silent, narrow-eyed men watched them from eyries on the hillsides and let them pass on by without speaking. Word of their coming had preceded them, and it was clear that these people had nothing against postmen, but it was just as obvious they had little use for strangers. Spending a night in the village of Sutherland, Gordon saw up close how the Southerners lived. Their homes were simple and spare, with few of the amenities still owned by those in the north. Hardly anyone did not bear visible scars from disease, malnutrition, overwork, or war. Although they did not stare or say anything discourteous, it wasn't hard to guess what the locals thought of Willameters. Soft. Their leaders expressed sympathy, but the hidden thought was obvious. "If the Holnists are leaving the South, why should we interfere?"